Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
I think we'll start off now. I think my voice may get people to sit down. So by the time I've got step one, the position I'm in is that I get up in the morning and I don't know if I'm going to drink that day, even though I'm going to AA meetings. And if I drink, I don't know if I'm going to be able to come back to AA tomorrow. And I've started to see at this point other people drink and try to come back and not be able to. So everything it says in the book suddenly starts to become crystal clear. This is reality. This is not a theory, as it says later on in the book. However, what I see around me is all sorts of people who are 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, 20 years, 40 years sober, who seem to have found a solution to this problem. Now, when I came to AA, I was very much impressed by these remarkable scrolls that you would have on the wall which listed the steps and the traditions. I had no idea they really had anything to do with AA when I first got here. I thought we're in church basements, there was something to do with the church. And certainly in London, I imagine Switzerland is very similar. Unlike the country in which AA was invented, we're not a religious lot in London, far from it. There is a lot of hostility towards religion. There is a lot of skepticism about anything spiritual whatsoever. I certainly was brought up an atheist, and I was militantly so. And so when I came to step two, and as I've come to step two repeatedly and in increasing depth over the years, in some ways, I've had to sidestep the God question because in a position of someone who has no contact with a power greater than oneself, how could one conceive of what that power might be? If you've never been to a country, someone's description of it is going to be totally inadequate. You have to go and experience the country to really know what anyone means. If someone describes alcohol to you and you've never drunk, how would you couldn't describe it adequately. You'd have to go and drink to understand it. And I believe it's the same with a power greater than myself. I'd have to experience it to understand it. So step two is not about getting a concept of a power greater than myself first and then taking step two somehow. It's about taking step two, trusting that the process itself will reveal to me the truth of what that power greater than myself is, which is why we agnostics, which is the chapter of the big book chiefly concerned with step two, although it mentions God and talks about God quite explicitly, the main thrust of its argument is not about God at all. It's about the other people in AA. It's about setting aside everything you think you know about a power greater than yourself, not being deterred by anything you taught as you were growing up, any thoughts or considerations or arguments that have filled your mind. One disregards those, and it talks about we're sticklers for facts and results. And the facts and the results are these. When I looked around me in AA, there were some people who were dying, there were some people who were frightfully miserable, and then there were some people who seemed to have found a solution not just to the fact that they were drinking too much, they were drinking alcoholically, but had solved other problems too. People who were functional in relationships, people who could be in relationships with others, even other people who are very damaged and very distressed and not be damaged and distressed themselves. I mean, that's a major solution. People who could, as a friend of mine puts it, show up for work and work while they're at work. These are two separate skills. People have solutions. So my question in step two is not, is there a God? Where's God? What is God? My question is, these people around me in AA, Do I believe them when they say they found a solution? When they talk about how dysfunctional they were, about how they could not help but have the first drink, do I identify with them? If I am now as messed up as they once were, and yet they found a solution, possibly could this work for me as well? That's really what step two is about. One brief set of ideas about step two. I could see, when I was new in AA, other people who were new as well, picking up all the tools laid at their feet, and they were starting to get well, they were starting to pull away from me. It's like when you're running in a race and there are people who are just running ahead of you and you don't know where the energy is coming from. I could see people around me doing things I wasn't doing and they were getting better. They seemed to have an energy and a momentum in their lives and they weren't slipping, importantly. I could see the effect of a power working in people's lives. I was already experiencing that in that I'd go to a meeting and people would talk absolute rubbish for an hour and a half and I would feel miraculously better and I wouldn't know why. And it's not because people were imparting great wisdom which cast my life in a whole new light. No, there was an energy operating in that room. I felt safe, I felt connected, I felt a little less like dying at the end than I had at the beginning. I could feel a power greater than myself operating in my life. I could see very clearly through the actions of other people that people that prayed, people that meditated, people that took steps 4 through 9, people that helped others, people that showed up, made tea, did service, seemed to access this power. And it's simply a matter of logic. If I can see power operating in people's lives, if I can feel power operating in my life, if I can identify what actions activate that power, the power is real and there is a source. Now, what that source is, I don't need to know any more than I need to know physics to operate a light switch. So, step two is terribly simple. Step three, I had to recognize, someone said to me once, "Are you happy?" And I said, "No." And they said, "How long have you tried to find a way to be happy?" And I said, "My whole life." And they said, "When did you think your plan was going to kick in? It hasn't kicked in yet." And my life was about sex, money, power, prestige, comfort, thrills, and appearance. I'll repeat the list. Sex, money, power, prestige, comfort, thrills, and appearance. My life was lived on this basis, and it did not bring happiness. It brought fear that my plan wouldn't work, frustration when it didn't, disappointment when everything went my way and I still felt empty and lost, and then despair that anything would ever work. But I had no other choice. Step three gives me another choice, which is very simply at the top of page 63. My concern is to stay close to God and perform His work well, which is going to mean telling the truth, listening to other people tell the truth, talking to God, staying quiet for long enough to listen to God talking through me, through my mind, through things I read, through other people, insisting on seeing God in everything, in every experience, insisting on seeing God in every person, even though God may be obscured by all sorts of other stuff, and being grateful. And performing His work well is very simple. Take the other steps. Engage in lots of fellowship, engage in lots of service, and lots of things become none of my business. My business had been chiefly, what do you think about me? I would spend my whole life thinking about what other people think about me, speculating, trying to manipulate it. I would spend a lot of time worrying about my identity. Who am I? I don't know who I am. Listing all the ways in which other people were mistreating me, thinking about my wants, thinking about my needs. To take step three is to make a decision that these are no longer my business. What you think of me is no longer my business. What I think of me is no longer my business. How you act is no longer my business. What I want is no longer my business. What I need is no longer my business. If I stay close to God and perform His work well, I will get everything I need, not just to be okay, but to be sensational. That's been my experience. But the only thing which will bring that about is steps 4 through 9. I can't click my fingers and find myself back in Kansas. That's all I've got on steps 2 and 3. I'll hand over to Laura.
Thank you. So my experience with steps 2 and 3 is long and drawn out, but I'm just trying to make a summary. And as Tim mentioned, there's a lot of help in this book. There's a lot of help from, available from other alcoholics. And I wrestled a lot with the God idea. Luckily, a couple things happened in the early days. I wasn't exactly a militant atheist, but I just had no connection with something greater than myself. I had, you know, I was confirmed in the Anglican Church when I was 12, but that was had not been a spiritual experience. And, you know, I found a lot of, as you see in the big book, I found a lot of the people going to church were, you know, I judged them as hypocritical, but because I thought they were just there to show off their new clothes. But those were false ideas inherited from someone else. But once I got step one, see, to me, step two and three fall kind of out of step two anyway. My willingness to believe in a power greater than myself came out of the desperation I felt when step one finally closed. Because step one tells me I'm between a rock and a hard place. I got a body that can't drink. If it does, it could end in death, and it had started to believe it. But I have a head that at certain times will tell me that I can drink or need to drink or whatever. You know, really between this rock and a hard place, and I was feeling very fragile. Up to then, because I didn't know what my illness was, I had been feeling, if not cocky, a little bit hopeful. But one thing that happened to me in the early days is I really started listening to people, and I realized they used words in different ways. And one day this thought came into my head. It wasn't my own thought. And I think it's a famous expression. I should have looked it up before I got here. And it was, the word is not the thing. Like, words are only symbols. And so I applied this to the God word, because it was kind of bothering me. And then my friend, with 4 months more dry time than I had, she tried to get me to conceive, you know, she tried to help me work around this conception of God. She said, you can have God any way you like it. Make a list of all the things you want from your God. And that didn't sit right with me either, you know, because I thought, no. It's not up to me to say what God is. Even though, but, so that happened to me. And then, one Sunday morning in a meeting, I was still very new, and it was a living sober meeting, which never really helped me, but I went to the meetings because, for lack of anything else to do, and to get out of the house where things were crazy. And a guy with a lot of years of sobriety who had tried to be kind and helpful to me in those 5 previous years of coming to me drunk, he shared in the meeting, he was frustrated by the militant atheists and the naysayers, you know, against the spiritual side of the program. And he happens to be quite religious, but that didn't matter at that point, because I was thirsty for an answer. And he almost shrugged his shoulders in the meeting. A very mild-mannered guy, you know. And he said, God is just life. God is just love. And when he said, God is just life, that helped me. And the love I couldn't quite connect to yet because I was so separated and sick. But the life, God is just like, he made it so simple for me, you know. You know, I was able to get over a hump there. But if we read step 2, it says, come to believe that power greater than ourselves can restore to sanity. And every time we talk about step 2 in meetings around where I am, we end up talking about God. Or this higher power, or our universal spirit, which, you know, Bill gives us many choices in chapter 4, we agnostics. But I do remember, I also have, well, it's not an AA publication, but it's the thing called the Little Red Book, which I don't use a lot. But in the Little Red Book, it says step 2 is about mental illness. It's about insanity. So I feel I should mention that today because most of the hospitals and clinics I went to in France where I live, but I did go back home to Canada once for a proper modeled after the Betty Ford Clinic's rehab in a mental health center outside of Toronto. And there I remember vaguely that they were talking about insanity. And at that time, that was in 2002, there was no way I would believe that I was an insane person. And the cliche sort of phrase, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. I couldn't get that. But mainly it was my pride and my arrogance because I could not admit that I was doing that, But this thing about, it is about mental insanity as I started out. If I have got step one and I see that my mind, even vaguely, because for me it seemed impossible, but I had to believe it was possible because we had a lot of visitors in the south of France and people would come and share about their relapses and about going out again, from AA. And that started to make me understand that just because I was sober, I may not stay sober. I got this gift of desperation, which funnily enough, the initials are G-O-D. We call it good orderly direction, gift of desperation. Of course, I was doing all this mind stuff around God, but you know what I had forgotten? I didn't get myself sober. I went to AA after 5 years of infrequently going there drunk and thinking it was all a bit of a joke that I was an alcoholic. It was only by the grace that I started going regularly, going every day, and really kind of, I don't know, you changed me enough that I could start listening. And after about almost 90 days, not quite, I woke up one morning, and after years, I don't know how many years, of waking up with my first thought was to replenish the supply I had drunk the night before. This day I woke up and something was different. And I didn't feel like drinking. And I've forgotten that when I was doing all this intellectual work around God, because I knew that a power greater than myself had lifted the desire to drink. And I have to remind that because I can get all intellectual about step two, but it's really simple, it can be really simple, especially the first time. As I said, I was blessed with some good mentors, and I tried to choose my own sponsors in the beginning, and that didn't work out really at all. And I got to this big book group, and they were encouraging us two women, we were two women, to find a sponsor. And they were on a bit of a spiritual hilltop at the time. But we'd say, well, how about this one? Should we ask this one? Should we ask this woman? Because we knew the women had to stick with women. And these people in my group were, well, we're not quite sure she does it by the big book. We're not quite sure. So eventually, one night, they decided to sponsor us. And so, I said, well, I'm pretty sure I've got a good handle on step one, and then I lied without knowing it. I said, steps two and three, I think I've been fighting with them for a few years. And you know what they did? They took me by the hand over to the wall where the steps were hanging, and they said, don't get hung up about steps two and three. And they showed me step 12, which I had been staring at on and off for years. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, and then it hit me. I didn't have to have God in step two. I didn't have to have that connection in step three, They said step three, they kind of even skipped at step two. And I'm just reading my experience. I guess I should get off that. Step three was a decision to do the rest of the steps. But there's a very clear outline here about how to take step three. And it's the bit after How It Works. up to the step three prayer on page 63 is very clear. It even says, if we're convinced of the ABCs on page 60, that I'm alcoholic, cannot manage my own life, if I'm convinced that I cannot stay sober on my own power, you know, I'm convinced I need to search for a higher power, I'm at step three, which is that I decide to turn my will and my life over to God if I understand Him, or don't even understand Him. Just what do I mean by that, and just what do I do? You know, it gives a very good outline, which doesn't in fact tell me what, well, there's one paragraph that tells me what to do. But it gives me a very good outline on what my life looks like run on my best thinking. And I have come to understand that my best thinking had gotten me into AA and my life in a mess only through the shares of many other alcoholics. You know, and I had started to learn that the problem was me. That was a huge shift in my consciousness. Just from all your shares. You know, because prior to that, I thought the problem was everybody else. That's why I was an alcoholic. But I had started to learn about that. And actually, Julia asked a question at the end of the last session about triggers. I had come to understand that all my triggers were inside me. And that I was the one somewhere that was pushing my own buttons. Vaguely, it's all very vague. You know, I didn't really get that until step four. But step three, I had to make a decision to stop doing it my way, basically. Stop doing it my way and do it this way. And by, you know, I really didn't have any other, I didn't have a better way of doing it. And as I said, I was in a very strong group, and they seemed to have found a solution. And it was a question of trust. You know, and by then I was, I don't know, 8 or 9 months dry, and I had started to learn to trust the AAs because I did realize that I actually knew nothing about getting sober or staying sober. And, you know, it was something to hang on to, even though I was dry. So step three is a decision, they told me, this is a decision to do the rest of the steps and see if you can get connected to your own higher power. I thought, well, that sounds good. But here it just says on the bottom of 62, and I feel this is where this is the actual instruction to use step three is the decision before the prayer. A lot of people think it's just, I take step three by doing a prayer, but on the bottom of 62, it says, this is the how and why of it. How I do step three and why. First of all, I have to quit playing God, running on cell phone. Why it doesn't work. And that made step three a lot easier for me too. Is that I didn't have to know what God was. I just had to know that my life, run on my best thinking, didn't work. And that I had to find a better way to live. I'll stop there.
So step four. People get very frightened of step four. There are only three things I'm concerned about in step four. How I think, how I feel, how I act. Now, I was there, so I already know. My day is already full of what I think, how I feel, and how I act. It's not like you're going to discover anything that isn't there already in front of your face the whole time. It's just a matter of writing down what is already there in front of your face. There are four inventories in step four. Three are explicit in the chapter How It Works. The fourth one is implied on the top of page 76, where it talks about in step eight, we made a list of the people we harmed when we took inventory in step four. And I'll take it from the back. That's a fairly simple one. It's just running through my mind, who do I feel guilty about that I've done something that's hurt them or upset them? Very simple list. And the sex inventory is a very simple list. It's got some very straightforward questions. List the people you've had relationships with and ask, where were you selfish, where were you dishonest, blah, blah, blah. And again, that's fairly straightforward, very repetitive. The two gold mine infantries are the resentment infantry and the fear infantry. And the resentment infantry starts in the bottom of 64. And if you're an alcoholic like me, you're very, very aware of how you feel. You're not very aware of how anyone else feels, but you're very aware of how you feel. And if anyone asks you, boy, will you tell them at huge length. The reason the resentment infantry is genius is because it starts with how you feel and it gives you 9 words which pretty much cover everything I've ever felt, certainly up until coming into AA. It talks about resentment, anger, hurt, threatened, sore, burned up, injuries, grudge, where we interfered with. These are 9 ways in. So my starting point in the resentment inventory is all of those things, wherever I'm hurt or upset or blah, blah, blah. And I'm looking for 3 things. I'm looking for who. Who's to blame? Which is marvelous. You start off with where you are. It's not very spiritual, apparently, but it really is. I make a list of all the people and situations that are to blame for why I'm so unhappy. Then I state very clearly, no essays, why. What did they do? What did they not do? What did they say? What did they not say? And then I'm looking for what area of self is affected. Does it affect their, what they think about me? Has what they have done changed their perception of me? I'm always worried about what other people think. And if something affects my pride, it's because I think they're, you know, I want them to think I'm amazing and talented and exceptional. They think I'm a schmuck. Pride. Self-esteem, when I fail at something, when I can't meet my own ambitions. Personal relations, if I have a plan for you and you don't follow the plan, it's affecting my personal relations. Ambitions and security are pretty clear. If something is getting in my way of all of my dreams, if something is getting in the way of my basic needs in order to be okay. And I get to write this out. I just get to tell the truth. The person, what they did wrong, and which area it affects. And then the real work begins with a sponsor. And we get to look at what the truth is. And the truth is, I've never seen reality as it is. What I will do, I will pick out tiny little fragments of reality. And then I will build on top of that all sorts of speculation. You know you're engaged in speculation if you think about the future or the contents of other people's minds. That's called speculation. None of us are mind readers. None of us are prophetic. Interpretation. If you have tried to work out what someone else's actions mean, what did she really mean when she said that? What did she really mean when she did that? Interpretation. Generalization. She always... Well, perhaps she did it once, perhaps she did it twice. With the help of a sponsor, I peeled away the interpretation, the generalization, the speculation to what the truth of the situation was. And then my sponsor got me to show, to look at what was behind their action, even when people are behaving badly. When I behave badly, I'm acting out of fear. When I steal, it's because I don't think there is enough for me, so I need to take what is there. When I'm mean to people, I feel that my self-esteem is threatened and I need to put you down so that I feel okay. When other people behave badly, they're acting out of fear, and I got to ask myself, why have I ever had the fear that might be prompting their activity? And when I can identify with other people, it's very difficult to judge them. If I'm going to get comfortable with the world, I need to look at all of the demands that I'm placing on the world. And I thought the world was doing all of these terrible things to me. What it was doing was failing to meet my expectations, failing to meet my demands. If I can stop demanding, if I can stop expecting, there is nothing there to hurt. And I don't know I have demands and expectations until I suddenly realize you're not behaving right and I need to point it out. So step 4 is the catalogue, ultimately, of how I'm putting you in charge of my emotions by running with a set of demands and expectations I'm not even aware of. I don't tell you they're even there. I just know I'm suddenly upset. And what this means is that you're in charge of how I feel. How you act dictates how I feel. And I wanted to be free. And I needed to forgive everybody for everything. And the only way to do that was to recognize that they are not harming me. They're harming my plans. And my plans never worked anyway. So I went through my life upset that my plan, which doesn't work, wasn't coming off. And I was blaming you. And I look at the times that all my plan did come off and I still wasn't happy. I still wasn't satisfied. I still wanted more and nothing was ever enough. And the insanity of having plans which don't work and being upset because other people won't fulfill them. And the prayer, the real work of step four, is the prayer on the top of 67 when I say, this is a sick man, or this is a sick woman, or this person is just they're just doing what they're doing, running through the world frightened, trying to get their own way, just like me. How can I be helpful? God, save me from being angry because I'm the one in trouble. Thy will be done. The fear inventory. I'm only ever frightened because I don't think I'm going to get my own way. Very simple. The solution to fear, it says on page 68, we're in the world to play the role that God gives us. I can't find the line, so that's a paraphrase. There we go. We're in the world to play the role he assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us, and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. When my life is based on my plans, sex, money, power, prestige, comfort, thrills and appearance, those things are not under my control. They're dependent on you behaving a certain way for me to get those things. And I'm going to be frightened. This is why self-reliance fails me, because my plans can never come off. When they do, they'll disappoint. The solution is to have a plan for life which resides inside me. And what I can say, and this is the solution to fear in any situation, I've got to deal with God. I say to God, you're going to look after me because I can't do it. Instead, I'm going to say to you, what's my role in this situation? Give me three adjectives to work with. So I go into a situation, what did I have to be this morning? I have to be truthful. I have to be concise. I have to be cheerful. No one wants a message from a misery. This is what my job was today. And I say to God, will you look after me if I try and spend the day being truthful, concise and cheerful? Now, the first time you try this, it's a bit shaky because you've never put your weight on it before. Once you've spent a few minutes of doing that, you start to see, this is working. Has anything bad happened to me today? No. Is anything bad happening to me right now? No. The bad things are not right now. They're my mental worlds I go into where I'm desperately worried about the future. That's where the badness lies. It doesn't lie in the reality around me. To get out of fear, I need to get out of those mental worlds and come back to right now. God, help me be truthful. Help me be cheerful and help me be concise. And with that last adjective in mind, I'm going to hand over to Lauren.
Yeah, step four. Tim covered it pretty well. My experience with step four, yes, is I had been taught to be afraid of step four and that I was going to discover all these unknown things about myself. But as it says, on page 64, the introduction to step four, it compares step four to a commercial inventory. I love this paragraph because it gets me into a little bit of an objective mind frame. Because up to then, my life had been all about me and very subjective, and I couldn't stand back from it. And it actually was, I had learned a little tiny bit thanks to Al-Anon. I had gone to a few Al-Anon meetings there in the early days. And every Monday they did a thing on detachment. So little by little I had to learn to step back from my own life. But step four is the greatest godsend. I can't separate it from these 12 steps because they're an integral package. But step four for me, who I started pointing the finger out there as soon as my younger brother was born, when I was two, I started blaming others. Maybe even Boyette. This was such an eye-opener. This changed my life, of course, with the step five. I did step four and five together. And I think all the inventories are important. But they start with the easy one, which is resentment. And I had been told in rehab that I was a very angry person. And I didn't believe them. But I was an angry person. I grew up in an angry household, alcoholic household. I was an angry person. And and step four was so easy, but I had to complicate it for a little while. You know, I sat down with my sponsor. We went quickly through step three. And he just wrote out the form. He basically wrote out a format in a notebook. We use a notebook. Keep all the pages together. If I give alcoholics pages of sheets of paper, then mix them all up. I even wrote out, anyway, I did this once to a person. She ripped them out of the book and then mixed them all up. So that the resentment was mixed with the sex and, anyway. But we use a notebook and, it's great. But I followed this example. And I tried to complicate it because I was listening in a gray group to Joe H. And there was a workbook with that study, and he had a little more advanced, complicated method of doing step four. And I've still never done it that way, but I set out to try because I knew sort of, or I was sure in here that step four was the key, and I had to do it thoroughly. And so, because of this overcomplicating things, my sponsor was waiting. How are you coming on step four? And after a few weeks, he said, why don't you just bring in what you have and we'll have a look at it. Of course, I had this list. And then, anyway, it was, and he said, I don't even remember how many people on it I had, maybe 40. It's not that many. But all the people who were close to me, really, and some people, like my divorce lawyer and things in the recent past. And he said, are you resentful against every single one of these people in here? I said, no. Who are they? Well, there's a lot in my family. You're resentful against everyone in your family? I said, no. Well, what are they doing there? And I said, well, I'm getting ready for step nine. Trying to be the star student. He goes, this isn't about step nine, this is step four. So he brought me back to reality, and he said, listen, just do the top 10 resentments. He said, you know when your last drink was, you don't know when your next drink is. And resentment is the number one offender. And I knew that because my last drink had been on the basis of resentment for sober. So I chose 10 people and did 3 resentments against each one, I think. But I'd had a little guide shot before that. It's actually on my way to get the instructions for step four from my sponsor. I had a 5-minute walk down to the cafe where we were meeting. I had this rolling over in my head because I'd heard over years in AA, what was my part in it? What was my part? And God said to me, God, whatever, this voice said to me, what was my part in the situation? Or what was my part in the resentment? And in that moment, I knew the resentment was 100% mine. Just like those triggers, which I picked up. But that, you know, that didn't come from me. And this was before. And so I got real curious as to know where this resentment, what part of me this resentment was coming from. But in that moment, I had started to own my own anger. Because up to then, I thought it was this uncontrollable emotion that, you know, came out, or resentments, you hear about them in AA, and you pick them up. You go through life and pick up resentment. You know, but in that moment, I knew they arise out of ourselves, just like it says in the book. But anyway, so it was very simple. I was told to keep the cause here, what people had done, hadn't done, to I had a maximum of 19 words, which is so good. No novel, no storytelling, because like Tim, I can write you a film about what happened. And I can attach different resentments together and then attach them to other people. So this helps me keep it, you know, very simple and very clear. And the four-step resentment prayer, that's so important. At first I had a hard time with thinking other people were sick because I felt it was condescending because I felt so sick myself. But then I realized it was like me. They are sick like me. And I've come to realize that, you know, a lot of people out there, well, everybody, has in more or less measure the same character defects I do. You know, this helped me become human, this program, because I could admit to having the same character defects that I pointed out in everyone else all my life. They have the same character defects I do. Whatever they do about it is their business. Mine make me drink, basically. But this is the thing. I have to remember, when I'm the one in trouble, I have to pray for me. God save me from being angry. I pray for other people, but in another context. I don't just pray for the other guy to get well so that he or she can stop bothering me. I hear that a lot in AA, and it's in one of the stories. Oh, well, if you have a resentment, just pray for the other person for 2 weeks. Maybe that works for some people, but I have to take my inventory and pray for my own character defects to be taken away. Because they're the ones that are creating the resentment in the first place. You know? And following instructions. I understood. You know, after resentment prayer, we avoid retaliation or argument, etc., etc., etc. I have to follow this instruction for the rest of my life as best as I can. But I mean, really, it's not just whilst I'm doing step four. Fear, definitely. My fear inventory was really short and sweet. Just the two questions. It can be done in 4 columns. But the 2 columns. What am I afraid of? Why do I have this fear? And when it was deconstructed, it was, what are you afraid of? And who's going to get hurt? And the answer to who's going to get hurt was always me. And it took me right back to the very first things I heard in AA. My problem was I, self, and me. And it really underlined the key before step 3, selfishness, self-centeredness, is the root of my troubles. You know? And it, you know. Yeah, that was the fear inventory. That was the step 4. I realized all my fears were about me. I never wrote one fear about anyone else, not even my daughter, that I love so much. You know? It was all my fears were about me. It's kind of set up that way so you can get trapped. But don't try to avoid it, because your sponsor will find a way of showing you that it's about you. The sex inventory, I understood. I heard this before I even did it. It wasn't about the sex. It was about the way I treated other people. That, you know, I was supposed to love or, you know, be in a special relationship. And I found out in that sex inventory, they don't even give me a chance in that inventory to complain about the other guy. It's really about how I treated them, you know, and how I showed up in those places. And it was a real closure. So I'll stop there. I'm over time.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.